this episode of the podcast.
For sure. I think it's very interesting to see who we are on this, like to see what are our capacities on different aspects, because we can be very good if we train specifically for one specific thing, like let's say vertical kilometer. But I think it's more interesting to know your vertical kilometer capacity, your climbing capacity, your like skiing and like running long distance and short distance and technical terrain and whatever it is, to see like to have a better picture of yourself. The first climbs in the Alps, like Matterhorn, Dent Blanche, Grand Capuchin, all the big mountains, or many of the big mountains in the Alps, they were climbed first by British people. And that's like, I think Sindre is probably the best like big wall climber in Norway and one of the best in the world. And his climbs in Trollveggen, Archwall, and the Norwegian road and the Russian road that he has like free climb, they are amazing. It's top class.
All right, guys, welcome to this extremely special edition of the NEDA podcast. My name is Hans Christian, and today I'm celebrating 100 episodes. 100 episodes of this crazy, crazy podcast. To celebrate 100 episodes, I figured I would invite the man who inspired me to start running in the mountains. And that guy is Kilian Jornet. And together we are going to really go deep into the history of our sport. I don't know if you know this, but Kilian has a website he calls Mountains and Athleticism, mtnath.com. And here he almost doesn't mention his name. It's like as if it's his anonymous geeky corner on the internet. And on this website, he just posts huge articles on the history of our sport and his training, his altitude acclimatization before he went to Everest, for example. Just tons of really cool resources. So I highly suggest you go to that website immediately. If you're not running while you're listening to this podcast, if you're sitting down, just go to mtnath.com or just click on the link in the show notes, and you can follow along on today's podcast. Because today we're going to go through one of his amazing spreadsheets. And this spreadsheet is called Chronology of Significant Activities. In this spreadsheet, Kilian has listed all events from the year 663 up until 2020, which he defines as significant when it comes to that it plays a significant role in the history of our sport. And he has split this up into alpinism, running, skimo, and climbing. So before this interview, I duplicated the spreadsheet, and I highlighted the events that I felt was relevant to do a podcast about. And since Kilian lives in Norway, I figured let's talk a little bit more about the events that he has written down on this list that is relevant to my Norwegian audience. For example, Stoltenkleven Opp or Ashfjordtraversen or things like that. But this episode is still very relevant for all international people listening to. And I assume a lot of international people are listening to you right now, so welcome. Since this episode was actually recorded on Zoom, you know, this video conferencing software, I was able to download the video afterwards. And what I did was that I took the video and I uploaded it to YouTube. And I've made a pretty cool video, because for every significant activity we talk about, I either have pictures or video. And I hope I'm not violating any copyrighted stuff there, but as long as it's on YouTube, It's probably one of the coolest videos on YouTube in 2020 so far, in my opinion. So just click on the link in the description and you can watch the video instead of listening to this this audio version. All right, so I'm not gonna keep you here any longer. I'm just gonna let you know how you can help out, support this show, because this show is not sponsored by any brands or anything. It's a completely crowdfunded podcast, which means right now 170 individuals out there are chipping in $1, $6, or $10 every single month. This is how I make a living. This is how I'm able to call Kilian and do all the research, do all the post-production, produce the video, produce the podcast, and deliver this content to you guys for free. So if you go to patreon.com/nedaproject, you can check out the different kinds of tiers or packages, or call it whatever you want. And you can see what kind of benefits you will get back, because this is not just donating money. You are actually getting exclusive content, behind the scenes stuff, early access to podcast episodes. This podcast with Kilian has been out for about a week before you're able to listen to it now on Spotify or iTunes. And yeah, just go to patreon.com/nedaproject and you can check it out. So thanks to everyone that's helping me out. It really means a lot. So thanks. Enjoy, guys. Enjoy episode number 100 with Kilian Jornet, and I'll speak to you in episode 101. And I think 101 will be in Norwegian. So that's a heads up. But if you are an international listener, just subscribe, because there will be tons of English content in the future. Okay? Enjoy.
And now for my next number, I'd like to return to the classics.
Hello, this is another one, baby. Welcome to Now Is It Alvor, with Hans Christian and friends. We're going to be the best podcast that you ever did here, and we're going to thrill you, we're going to teach you, we're going to entertain you. Like Britney Spears once said, there are those of us who observe and those of us who are here to entertain. And we're here to entertain you, bitch.
No. Okay, wow, yeah, so kind of the same. Yeah.
So you've listened to the podcast. I know we
I have been listening some of podcasts. I was doing a long travel.
What do you
and I listen
you drove your car down to France or something, down to the Alps, and you were listening to the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How is your Norwegian?
Well, I understand, but I don't speak much. Yeah. Like, it will be very, very poor.
Yeah, because I don't know. Do you socialize with the Norwegians there, or is it mostly?
No, it's a good outdoor community here. Like, it's very good skiers. We go off into the mountain together.
Yeah. Nice. Okay, you got the agenda for the podcast, right? What do you think? What do you think?
Laura sent me. Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
So I thought we could just geek out on the Excel or the spreadsheet that you have created, and kind of have that as the agenda. And if you wanna stop and talk a lot about one subject, that's okay. Like, it doesn't really matter. If we stop on the year 1886, then that's fine. Yeah. So there's no reason okay, to rush. No reason to rush, you know.
No problem. Yeah.
So I don't know. We can just say that we have already started. I'll do intro afterwards and stuff, and I can just wish you welcome to the podcast, Kilian.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's cool to be here. And to talk with you.
Yeah, I thought this would be a brilliant way to introduce you to my Norwegian audience, because you're kind of this, I don't know, you're just this mystical creature down in Åndalsnes. Everybody knows there's a really fast guy living there, and like, what is he doing? He's crushing all the segments on Strava. And you know, when I started the sport was like 5 years ago, I saw you in Tromsø. You were giving a medal to my friend after the Tromsø Sky Race. I had done the half distance, the Tromsdalstind, and my friend had done the Hamperåken one.
And oh, nice.
And, yeah. And that kind of inspired me to continue and
that's cool.
And do more of it. And you know, people were surrounding you and doing selfies, and I was like, who is this guy? And I think a lot of Norwegians have the same. They know, they've heard your name, but they don't really know like who you are. So if we can picture my audience, they're Scandinavian, and this could be also relevant for the rest of the world. But let's just picture we're speaking to my Norwegian audience.
No problem. Yeah. It's nice that you run in Tromsø.
Yeah.
Hope you enjoy the race.
I'm from Tromsø, so it's.
You know what the area.
Yeah. Hey, before we go and get into the subject of today's podcast, you lived in Tromsø for a while, right?
In Lingen. Like my wife Emily, she was studying in Tromsø, and she has been living there for a few years, and then we moved 1 year to Lingen, actually, a bit south from Lingside.
Okay.
And we were living there for a few months. And then like we were back to Chamonix, and then we moved to Romsdal.
Okay, so you didn't stay there for those 2 years, or did you stay in Lingen for 2 years?
We stayed for 1 year, from the autumn to the summer, kind of.
All right, we'll get back to the Lingen, because Lingen and Tromsø, because we have an agenda, Kilian, and you have created, you're a numbers geek and statistics geek, and you have created this awesome spreadsheet which you call the chronology of significant activities, and I found this on it's your website, right?
I have this kind of website, like a mountain athlete, where I mostly like just put resources that I found interesting, or like my training logins, and like the sheets that I use to plan projects, and like information that I find interesting to when I plan expeditions or races or historical thing. So I have this. It's not like my website, but it's a place where I just drop things like resources that I found that they can be useful.
Yeah, and it's called mtnath.com, so mountain ath, kind of mountains and athleticism. And it's an incredible resource, actually. So I'll link to the website in the show notes for the podcast for my listeners.
Oh, thanks.
There's a ton of content there. You enjoy.
Yeah, I like studying, so it's cool to, when you do research, to just put it somewhere so people can find it.
Yeah,
even if like my goal with there is not like to find, like to have a lot of traffic, but it's just like to have somewhere so when people is asking about like a training log or about a kind of session, then I can just send the link and they can find it there.
Right, because if you want the traffic, you would call the website Kilian Jornet Bergale, right?
That's my official
website. It's very anonymous.
It's more to have just things not related only about me.
Yeah, so this this spreadsheet is pretty much just a big list, a chronological based list, starting from the year 663. And I don't know, have you like gone deep into all these events, or how deep have you gone?
Yeah, well, like I'm someone that likes to know we come from and like why I'm doing activities in the style I'm doing now. And that's because I had some influences. And then these persons that they has been influencing me, they had their own influences and mentors. And actually, why we go to the mountains in alpine style or in single push or like that today, and it's because people has been doing before. And it's interesting, I think, to look to the past to see, yeah, what we do. And it's interesting to look to the story and to the history. And yeah, some of the, I has been like researching all these dates and all these facts. And some, like, I have much more information. Some I just know, like, a small note in a book that say, I don't know, this guy ran this mountain in this time at this year. And that's all that I have. But it's, I think it's cool to put there so we see. And actually, it's only, it's like the spreadsheet is about, like, activities carried on a fast and light way in the mountains. And then it's another about, like, competitions in the mountains. So it's about, yeah, with this kind of like fast and light activities and competitions in the mountains. Yeah.
And to prepare for this podcast, I highlighted some events in green just to like, things that to me stuck out and would be relevant for a Scandinavian audience, because you included some Norwegian stuff there. So I thought we could also just stop, talk a little bit more when we when we get to like Storstenkleven up in Norway, you know. That's that's really cool. So I don't know,
it's cool that you know, Norway has an incredible story about like mountaineering, and it's many of the greatest alpinists are from here. Like if you see like the big climbs in Pakistan, the Trango Towers and things like that, they were made from Norwegians. So I think like of course it's very hardcore Norwegians climbing around and running.
Yeah, but no, running in the mountains is not it's pretty new to Norwegians, right?
I would say like what we call like trail running, that is more like up and down and long distance, I would say it's pretty new in Norway. But I think Norway has a long history about like uphill races.
That's right.
Like
that's
races, right. And that's like probably from like cross country skiers, like running in summer. Like you live in a, like it's a country that it has a lot of mountains. Every town, like especially the coast, like is not flat land. So of course, like people is running to the summits, and I think that's the that's part of it, that it has a big story about climbing mountains and running mountains fast.
Yeah, but it's always been like the secondary thing to do. We always wait for the winters. It's always been cross-country skiing and other stuff. That's been our main goal, right?
So yeah, sure. But that's logical. Like, of course, it's much more fun to ski than to run. Like,
you think so?
You get into that. Yeah. So? Like, absolutely. Like, one of the reasons we moved to Norway, it was to have long winters, to have long ski seasons.
All right, and you moved from the north, I guess, also to avoid the dark and depressing winters.
mostly to be a bit closer. Also, when we travel, and my wife likes to have big gardens, so it's a bit easier to have a big garden down here.
Yeah, I would assume. So let's get into the list, shall we?
Let's go.
You can take kind of I don't know, you'll be the master of the list. Do you know anything about the first event that you have on the list, which is the Mount Fuji event?
Well, like it's very hard to see when like climbing mountains started, like why, and probably like the first dates that we can. Like most people consider like the beginning of alpinism. Mm-hmm. It could be like the first ascent of Mont Blanc in the 1786, or it could be the first climb of Mont Aiguille in France too in the 1492. But before we can see like Petrarca or Enno Honshu in Japan, or it was more like kind of religious things, like to climb mountains to find like peace or to on a poetic way. So probably those are like kind of the the beginning of like people climbing mountains, not for any other reason than to climb the mountain, not for like going to get food or not for like wars, but just like to climb the mountain because they are there. So it was trying to find where people start climbing, and it was most like kind of poetic or religious at the beginning, until I would say until Mont Blanc climb, where then it opens. People started to climb mountains then for the pleasure of climbing mountains, or for the discovery and exploration.
So that was the game changer. And what year was that? You said 14.
Mont Blanc, it was in the 1786, first climb of Mont Blanc. Before it was some climbings, but it was very like, they were kind of isolated. So not, it didn't start to be like a regular activity before then.
All right. Do you want to jump directly to that event, or should we talk about?
Well, I think it's also interesting, like on the trail running, that we think that trail running is a new sport, like probably because like with the social media and today, we think that trail running was invented like 10 years ago, but in UK, especially like in Scotland and in the Lakes District, what it's fun that we can look and we can see that it's races that they has been performed there since very long time ago. It's this first hill race that it was in Scotland in the 1040. That's incredible, like in that more than 1,000 years ago, that people was running in the hills doing races, and it was more like kind of for a job, like to get courier and things like that. But in the 1800s, it was like the fell running and trail running in the UK was a big thing already.
Yeah, and something I did some googling on the event in 1762. There was this guy called Foster Powell. He ran 100 miles in 21 hours and 20 minutes in 1762. That's pretty cool. And he is kind of he's called the father of pedestrianism.
that was fun. I also discovered that last years, and it's cool that at that time it was this pedestrianism thing that it was like people running and walking these long distances, and it get the thing that was probably the beginning of the long distance, the ultra running, because they were like running quite good times, he ran like the 100 miles and the 50 miles and like 120 miles, and then like it was him, and then like it was other competition, and I think it was like kind of discussions between the professionals and the amateur runners, and like the ones that they get paid for that, and it was kind of entertainment. I think it was like really a lot of people like going to follow them and to see if they were able to arrive to that city that day, and it make a kind of a business and a big entertainment at the time.
Yeah, and then let's jump over to, I don't know, you know, I highlighted the stuff in green. You can stop in between on other events if you want. But my next event was in 1820. And of course, we jumped over the 1786 event to the climbing of Mont Blanc. But we already talked about that. Should we?
That's a bit the beginning of what we call today fell running and trail running. Fell running started to really be something like competitions and regular, because if we see like in those years from the 1820, it really started to pop up races in the UK, in Scotland, and in the Lakes District mostly. And actually, I don't remember which race was exactly, but I was reading that they were some nude races. Also, people were running nude, and And that's a funny thing that it was really connected to nature. Like I read somewhere that it was a note saying that in the 1820 some, it was this fair race, this nude fair race in this village that couldn't be stopped by the police, even if they try hard. So that the police couldn't stop the nude fair races at that time. And yeah, it's cool. Like where the sport comes from, it comes from the UK, and from these places. And that they were like doing cool things. Like it was steep. If we see like it's very short races in general. Like they were mostly like between 2 to 5 kilometers, but with 400, 500, 600 meters of elevation. What means that they were very, very steep races.
And they were nude.
Yeah, and they were nude. Yeah, so it was not discussion about the benefits of like the carbon plates or no.
Right, but they were thinking about the grams, right? They were all about the weight, so they didn't actually have to think about
it. It's pretty technical terrain because in UK actually the races are not marked and it's just like you go up that hill and go down, so you can choose the way that you go. So it's it's not like following a trail; it's just to go up and down straight lines.
Yeah, and they still do that, right? That's part of the game.
Yeah,
just get to the top
of
the hill.
Yeah, it's part of the culture. Mm. Yeah, it's a very different. Like now we can see, like for example, in Europe, that races, trail running races, are like big events with like a lot of participants, like races with 4, 5, 10,000. Runners and with like a lot of marketing around and like a huge big registration fees and in UK it's still very like low profile races, like very low fees, like you can enter a race for £5-10 and just like go run and go back, and that don't mean that the level is lower, but it's just like the culturally is very different.
Yeah, because it's been in the culture for hundreds of years.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, moving on. I see you have your cursor, because I can see your cursor, because we're sharing the same Google spreadsheet. You have your thing on 1850 with Sondre Norheim, the Norwegian.
Yeah.
And
you probably know much more about him than me.
I'm living.
But, he invented.
Yeah, you go. Yeah.
He invented the skiing. I would say, like the turn, like the modern skiing, like to do skiing for fun, to do skiing for like a competition, and telemark skiing and like parallel skiing. It was born here in Norway, and Sondre Norheim was probably one of the fathers of it.
I actually don't know that much about him. I know he moved to the US and spent most of his grown-up years over there. I think after he was maybe in his 40s or something. I'm living at a friend's place, and he's American. And he said, "Oh, you're going to talk to Killian, and you're going to talk about the significant activities. You should talk about Sondre Norheim," he said. Because he moved to Norway because he was inspired by Sondre and his telemark style. So it's
that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you see, like we call telemark ski because it's the region of telemark. We call like today everywhere in the world it's slalom. The discipline alpine skiing slalom is because the village also slalom, that it's I think pretty close to Oslo. The turn, like the parallel turn, is the Christiana turn, and that's like Christiana is like the old name of Oslo.
Yeah.
So we see that it's from this, it's from Sondre, and I think if today skiing is a sport, it's not only a way to transport ourselves, it's because probably he had a big role on doing the demonstrations and also like exporting this sport to the US and to Europe,
and also to tweak his gear. I know he did a lot of experiments with the bindings and the skis and improved a lot on that.
Yes, true. He started to do this kind of leather, like fixed bindings, and yeah, to be able to, yeah, probably to do this more like technical skiing.
Yeah. All right, that's the first Norwegian. And you've categorized these in running, skimo, alpinism, and climbing, I guess. So that was skimo, and
yeah. It's not really skimo, but it's kind of where we come from, like the skiing part.
Right. And I'm going to jump all the way down to 1880, which is 30 years later. And there's this guy called William Cecil Slingsby. And I've heard the name before, but I had to Google him. And do you know anything about him?
Well, like what I know is like here in the region where we live, it's a lot of Slingsby roads. So he was someone that was doing a lot of mountaineering and a lot of exploration here in Norway. I know in Storevengetind, that is the highest mountain here in Romsdal, is the Slingsby face. That's because he was the first to climb there. He was doing these long crossings in ski, so he was more an explorer. And at the time, I think that these mountain regions they were pretty unexplored. It was very wild; like people wasn't really climbing mountains, and he was really really discovering all these places and opening to others to do things. And that's I would say, like, with the Victorian period in the UK with exploration, people was like, or yeah, especially English people was like exploring lands. Like, it could be from the exploring the Arctic, the Antarctic, going to the Himalayas, going to yeah, different jungles. So I think the Victorian movement have a lot to do with like alpinism and with the skiing. And here in Norway, Slingsby is probably one that took this way to explore all these mountains on skis.
The crazy thing is he's British. He's from the UK. He's not even Norwegian. So I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, no, but that's the funny thing, that you can see like the first climbs in the Alps, like Matterhorn, Dame Blanche, Grand Capuchin, all the big mountains, or many of the big mountains in the Alps, they were climbed first by British people and not by French or like Italians or Swiss people. Or like here in Norway, you can see that many of the roads that those years were opened by British, and also with the exploration in Himalayas. All the first big expeditions, like in Everest, was British people. So I think it's them that they had this culture of a sport and about an exploration, and they just went to these countries to do activities, and then local people say, "Oh, wow, that's cool. We should do that too." So they really inspire the locals to go out to the mountains.
Yeah, and this guy was actually in the Lingen Alps a lot. He's been exploring the northern part of Norway as well. And also, I think he was at Kvaløya, and you know the area well, right?
So
That's interesting. I don't know why he went north, but that's cool. We'll get back into Kvaløya and Ashfjordtraversen. You have a record there. I want to talk about it. Yeah, so let's move on. What do you think about the next event?
You were highlighting here. Yeah, I think it's the fell race that was
naked
event.
We talked about that.
We talk about that, like the explosion of like fell running in the UK those years. And actually, we can see that most of the races during the 1800 was mostly on in the UK, and we need to go to the 1900 to start to see much more races like appear in other countries. Trail running, like we can see It was the Vignemale race in the Pyrenees in the early 1900s, or like you highlight the Lipsia race in San Francisco. That's also in 1905. That's a very cool race. It's a very cool concept, actually. I have never raced. Yeah. I have been in San Francisco and in the area. But the cool thing they have is this handicap system. So actually, you start depending the time you will finish. So let's say the first to start the race are the 80-year-old people and the 6-year-old girls. And then it's like the 7-year-old girls and the 70-year-old people. And then like lower until the last ones to start are the pro athletes. So some years is a pro athlete that wins the race, and some year is a 5-year-old boy, and some other years is a 70-year-old woman. So they made the system that everybody can win the race, because like the pro athlete might need to run in like, I don't know, like 30 minutes and the to win the race, and the 7-year-old boy need to run in like 1 hour 10. So that's very cool that
that's awesome.
Is this kind of handicap system. Yeah.
I wonder who decides the level of handicapism. But that's a different story.
Yeah, I think it's about ages mostly.
Yeah.
I would say I think it's about the age.
And it's probably based on statistics.
I don't know if they have something about I think it's pretty accurate. Well, they had some data from 1905, so
yeah,
probably they could do a lot since then.
Yeah, so that's 1905. Now let's keep in mind, we're entering the 20th century, and we have two world wars coming up. My next event is I highlighted 1921. Which was the first edition of the Comrades Marathon. I don't know if you want to talk about anything between that and 1905.
Well, I would say like between that, probably in the early of the 20th century, it was the beginning of like races. We could see like mountain races, like climbing up and down summits, or like the first ski mountaineering races. I would say there it was the beginning of what we call the movement today, of like competitions all around the world of both the ski mountaineering and trail running. But yeah, I would say that probably Comrades Marathon was one of the first ultra races that it has been keeping until today. Road race. And it's a huge race. Like I have never been there, but it's amazing the level that it has and the number of participants.
Do you think you'll ever do it, or do you, is there something you
want
to do?
I don't think so. Like I don't think like I hate roads. I like to run on mountains, and like to do a long travel, to do a 90K road race. Like I don't see myself on that. No.
Yeah, when you put it like that, I guess. What do you think you're ever gonna do a marathon on road?
Well, like this year, actually, I'm training for like running on asphalt, and I would say like I has never run on flat, so it's interesting to do this transition, and I will see after a few months if I don't get injured, because it's pretty different on the biomechanics. But yeah, I would like to do something on flat. So I will see the distance when I have a few months of training, and I can see that I'm not getting injured. But we'll try to do something this autumn if we are able to race by then.
Yeah, right. If things open up. Yeah, that's exciting. It'll be exciting to see how fast you can go. I don't know. Do you have a goal or a hunch of how fast you can go for 42Ks?
I would say it's very hard to know, because I have never run flat. So and especially like I have a good VO2 max, and I have a good threshold, but my running economy is very poor because I have never run in road. So I need to really improve that to be like a decent runner. So I really don't know. And that's the other thing. Like I need to see if I don't get injured. So it's very like, I have no idea.
That's a cool really. Experiment.
Like, I have no idea what to expect. That's the cool thing. Yeah. To jump to something that, it's completely wide for me.
Have you done a 10K?
I have done in training, never racing. In training, I'm doing like on the 29 minute range. It would be interesting to do some races on that too, to push a bit more. I think it's very interesting to see who we are on this, like to see what are our capacities on different aspects, because we can be very good if we train specifically for one specific thing, like let's say vertical kilometer. But I think it's more interesting to know your vertical kilometer capacity, your climbing capacity, your like skiing and like running long distance and short distance and technical terrain and whatever it is, to see like to have a better picture of yourself.
Yeah, definitely. All right, we have a list. Kilo, we need to get.
Yeah, let's go there.
Keep going. My next one is the Bob Graham round. You have a relationship with that.
Actually, the Bob Graham is it's a loop in the Lakeland in the UK. It's a long loop. I think it's like 105, 106 kilometers, and you link 42 summits in the lakes. And the first time that someone ran it, it was in the 1932, and it was Bob Graham that did it under 24 hours. And since then, like people has been running, doing it. And I really got inspired when I started trail running. I remember in some races in Zagama the first year, it was some runners from the UK, Ricky Lightfoot and Rob Jett, that they were like going there and they talk about this Bob Graham thing, and I got inspired by the times and how fast they were running. And actually, it's the generation of runners, Billy and Kenny Stewart, and Josh, they were very, very fast. Like actually many of the records, like Ben Nevis race has never been broke since they did it, or the Bob Graham, like I managed to break it like 2 years ago, but it was like very serious times, and that makes like know that in the 60s and the 70s, the level of these athletes, it was amazing. They were, and I think like it was Kenny Stewart that he was a fell runner, and then he decided to run a marathon and he won. I don't know if it was Paris, but he did like 2:10 in the first marathon, like after like a career on fell running. So it says how fast they were, these guys on the mountains.
Yeah. So that was that the first time someone that Bob Graham ran it in 1932. So that
In 1932 it was Bob Graham that ran it under 40 and the under 24 hours.
So is that kind of the official first real FKT?
Might be like I think like since the moment that someone ran something or climb a mountain, it's the fastest known time on that.
So
probably it's probably it's the first time that it was like a club around that people was like signing in when they were doing it, so like they record like a list of people that was doing this run.
Yeah, cool. And then 4 years later we have an event in the US. It's the Pikes Peak, right?
Yeah, that was actually it was the third marathon in the US with a marathon like road marathons included, and it was actually the first marathon in the US that allowed women to participate. At that time, I think it was Boston, and I don't know which was the other marathon that was racing, but they didn't allow women to participate, and and Pikes Peak, Assen. Yeah, it allowed women to run it.
In 1936 or later?
I think from the 36
from the start.
It was allowed, and then when the from the start it was a woman allowed.
Cool. And yeah, and of course it has a deep history, and you've been there, and you've tried to do your best at taking the record. The record is further down on the list, so we can get back to it. We can get back to that. Okay, so that was 1936. I don't know. I highlighted this event in Japan in 1947 because I just it's fun. We think about running and alpinism. We think about Europe and the U.S. and sometimes some Europeans went over to Himalayas in the 40s and stuff. But things were going on in Japan too. You know. Here's this uphill
you
race in Mount Fuji.
The races. Yeah, it's the races in Japan, and Japan has a big history in alpinism too. So it's to see that the sport was something global, even if at that time probably the communication was not really as today, that we can really communicate around the world. But we can see that the sport was growing all around.
Do you know if there are any big influencers, like people that were traveling around, inspiring other communities to start doing races?
Not that much at the time. More in climbing, but in running, not that much. And it was more like that it started like locally. Yeah. Mm.
Then that's kind of a good example that running to the top of the hill is something primal, something that comes from, that's just natural.
Yeah, it's simple. Like you live in your place, you have mountain behind, and obviously you want to go there, and then you want to run faster because to see if you can run. I think it's just how we are.
Yeah. Now there's this next thing, which is in 1953, when Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay climbed Everest. That was the first ascent, successful ascent.
It was the first ascent of Everest in 1953, and that I think it really popularized the climbing, the scene, and of course like climbing the highest mountain of the earth. It was a huge achievement, and knowing that it's incredible to think that it was in the 1921-22. It was Norton and Snowdon that they climbed to 8,600 without oxygen. That makes realize how hard it must be at the time, because the gear that they had at that period is not the technical crampons and boots and switches that we have. They were with leather jackets and with leather boots. And that's tough. It's incredible, to see how they were climbing at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And compared to your gear when you went up there a couple of years ago.
Yeah, like I had like 6 kilos on my backpack.
Yeah.
To climb Everest, and then like they were like talking about tons of equipment to bring there. And then like the mountain also now is much more accessible. Like we have the information, we have like pictures from other expeditions. It's a trail to the bottom of the mountain. At that time it was also a lot of exploration because they didn't know what to expect up there.
Now you know, before this interview, I would call it, I sent you a clip, audio clip. I don't know if you listened to it, but it did you check it out?
Yeah
Did you find it interesting?
Yeah, I think like as you see, like I love the story, and like to look at the past to understand what we do, and it's so interesting to see how he was doing, and And yeah, the yeah, how it was at the time, like in the 53.
Yeah, because
it's interesting to have insights on that moment.
Right, because just to explain to the listeners, I was in Nepal in November last year, and I did the Everest Trail Race. And before the Everest Trail Race, I was there for up in the Khumbu Valley just to acclimatize and train and look around. And I was in Namche Bazaar, and there were some rumors that there was one person that still was alive from the 1953 expedition, and he was in that house right over there, you know, sitting over there. And you can talk to him if you want, and you just have to pay him a little fee, and the profit goes to he has some kind of a foundation where he supports the local school or something. And so that's what I did. I went there and I took my recorder, and I did a 30 minutes interview. And the reason that it hasn't been released on the podcast is because, you know, you listen to the clip, it's pretty, his English is not that good, but it's interesting for people that really want some inside info. Maybe I can play like 1 minute right now, you know, because this, I'll edit it.
Yeah, sure.
I'll edit later. So now.
Yeah.
Then after 3 months in Zinze, we go to Chomulomo.
Chomulomo, which is the name of Everest.
Everest, yeah. And we shall rock on the Chomulomo.
Yeah, oh, Chomulomo.
Chomulomo.
Yeah. But did you know that it was the highest mountain in the world?
We never saw.
No.
I heard Chomulomo, but never saw. Chomulomo, I never saw. Mm. Mountain, many mountain here, we know this sort of mountain.
You never went up to the valley?
Never
no.
saw.
No.
We only Namche, but I never go to up the Tengboche Valley.
You never went
never,
up to Tengboche?
Never, okay. Then next day, Hillary come, New Zealand to
yes.
Kathmandu. Hillary group come.
So Hillary came from New Zealand, and he brought a lot of Brits.
Then he bring the every equipment, food, oxygen, tents, sleeping bags, equipment. The one we stay Kathmandu, Bhattapur, 1 week.
Okay.
Then everything equipment come. Then we pick big box, and then we pick for 30 kilos of weight put on board a lot.
30 kilos?
30 kilos. Then we 400 porters.
400 porters?
400 porters.
And wow.
Port back we picks.
Did you walk from Kathmandu to yes. here? To Namche?
Then we, after 1 week, then we find the porter, then we start Kathmandu here, 16 day.
Okay, and did you do the Giri trail?
No Giri trail.
No.
Nor other way. We call that Rishunga. Rishunga is another way.
Okay.
All right, we're back. you've heard Kansha Sherpa, and now we're gonna scroll down on our list, and the next event is. The Three Peaks race in the UK, right?
Well, I think that in the 50s, and you see the Three Peaks, and it was like, I think, yeah, trail running at that point started to be much more global and started to be more like all kind of races, because we have the Three Peaks, that it's a marathon in the UK. A few years or yeah same or like 2 years after, it was the Pikes Peak, the marathon. It was the first like races, mountain running races in Italy, and I think that then it was when really like the sport started to be more like more global and more regular.
Yeah, I saw Tom Evans did the Three Peaks on a treadmill the other day.
Wow, that's impressive. It's I have never raced it, but as you said, like many friends, like Tom or Emily, had raced it too, and apparently it's a classical fell race for T2K technical terrain, just go straight down up. So it's a pretty good race. Like to do a treadmill, it must be hard. Well,
yeah, I don't
it's
know.
Not the mud that makes the specific, but
there's no downhill on treadmill. Or I mean, there are some treadmills with the downhill.
Not mud and not.
All right, and that was in 1954 in the UK. And my next one is all the way down to 1961. I don't know if you want to stop, if there is a significant event before that.
No, I think in 61 it was Besegloppet here in Norway, and that's incredible. We were talking at the beginning that Norway have not like a big culture on trail running, and I was bringing up the uphill races, but here we can see that the Besegloppet is a long race. I think it's like 20K or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but it's a proper like mountain race with uphill, downhill, and it's incredible that it was raced at that time. And it's a race that is still going now. I was racing a few years ago. And it's an incredible race. It's so beautiful, like just run in between these big mountains with the lake, and it's an incredible race. Yeah,
it's called the Besegloppet, and I think we can say that it's the most famous ridge in Norway, because it's on one side you have the huge blue lake called Jende. And it's just amazing.
People should go there to visit and to do the race, or just to do the ridge, because it's a wonderful place on in Norway.
Yeah, I think for normal people to hike, I think it takes 7 hours or something. What how long did you run for?
Oh, I don't remember at all. I'm so bad on remembering these things. I have no idea, but what it can be like, I'm sure that it's like 2 hour race or shorter than that.
Yeah. All right. Now in 1963, we have, I don't know why I really brought this up, but it's the JFK 50. Maybe I just highlighted it because we shouldn't forget about the US. Now we've been very
European. Yeah, in the US.
Yeah,
in the US, that was the FKT races. I think it started as it was the military that bring it up, and it was kind of a celebration, or like I think it was like the president say to the troops that they should be able to run like 50 miles or something like that, and then like some people started to say to put the races on, saying okay, we can do like the militaries or some kind of like that story. So that was kind of those years it started to pop up a lot of like 50 miles around the country. Mm. And today probably the most famous is the GFKT 50 miles. And it's great that it's still going on today.
Yeah, that's why I highlighted it, because it stands out. I remember the name. That's pretty much, that's why. And my next event, I don't know, maybe we're jumping a bit too far, but I jumped to 1973.
Yeah, 73. Well, seriously, now it's a race that I love it. Like, it's one of my favorite races. Mm. I has been racing there, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 times. And it's a pure mountain running race. It's in Switzerland. It's from the 73, so it's a pretty old race. But I would say that probably in terms of mountain running is the most famous race that's running today. It's perfectly organized. It's the landscape is wonderful. Like you are in the core of on the Alps with Matterhorn, Dim Blanche, Weisshorn in front of you. So it's an amazing landscape you are running, and it's a pretty fast race. It's a big climb, like 2,000 meters. A straight climb, but then it's like flat, to the finish, more or less. And it's always like a high competition. I have been, having very good times there. It's a race that I like to go back every year, because I know that every year is it's a huge competition. And also some Norwegians, they has been running there the last years. Johan Bugge, Stian, they has been doing like some good results there.
Mm. I was there last year. I saw you running down
The last downhill. Were you racing?
No, I was just hanging out in Zinal. Training.
Nice. Yeah, it's a cool place, huh?
Yeah, it's one of the most beautiful places I've been.
Yeah.
Really. All right. Now, 1974. A pretty big event happened in the US.
Yeah, that was the born of like the Western States, and probably like what we could call like the beginning of the ultra trail. And this movement, and that's a funny story behind, is that actually it was a horse race. It was the Tevis Cup, but it was a horse race, and it was a few days or weeks before the race. One of the participants, Gordy, his horse was injured, so he could not the horse could not do the race. And he was asking if it was possible for him to run it instead. And I think it was a bit of controversy at the moment, but then like they let him run, and they will class him if he could finish under 24 hours. And he did it. So that's how it started. Like it was a horse race, and a injured horse started the movement of like ultra running. So we need to be thankful to that horse injury to be today here.
Right. If it wasn't for that horse, we wouldn't be sitting here. You've done the race a couple of times, and I think because of the coronavirus, they released the Unbreakable Western States documentary film for free a couple of weeks back. So I think a lot of people have seen the documentary now. I saw it for the first time, I think 3 or 4 years ago. And that was really inspiring. And of course, I saw you.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's the 2010 edition. Like, it was a very fun run. Like, it's an amazing race. Like, it's very hot, very, very hot. Mm. And that year with Anton Kuprichka, that he is one of the guys that really take this sport ultra running to a larger audience. Jeff was one of the best runners at the time. He was winning all the races, and Carl Horner and Nick Clark. Like it was a very cool race, and I think it was also the beginning of like the ultra running as a mass sport. Like I would say between in the 2009 2010, it really exploded as a sport. Like before, it was just like those freaks that go running. And those years, like I think with probably my victories in UTMB and Anton Kuprika, Zimaj and victories and the sport that it just like races started to be everywhere, and these big races with UTMB and Western like being more popular, they just took the ultra running to some kind of mass sport.
I'm curious because I watched the your film Path to Everest, and you described there that you kind of as a young boy you had this list of things you wanted to do or races to complete, and that race or that list became kind of a list that of races you wanted to win, and then you won all those races. But how did you find out as a pretty young man about these super niche races like Western States? Because when I was I don't know how young you were, but when I was 18, I did not do research on a 100-mile race in the US. How did, for example, Western States end up on that list?
Well, like I came from like ski mountaineering, so like my My backyard was more like a like Pieramenta, Mezzalama, and the sky running races. So like Zegama, Dolomites, Sierzinal, that they were more on what I was doing. And then actually when I did UTMB, I heard about UTMB the first time. I don't know how, like some people saying or whatever. And then I raced there, and then I get more into the ultra running world. And then I started to look what was other on this distance. And then is where I discovered like these races like Western States, Hard Rock, Diagonal de Fou. But yeah, probably, yeah, it was because running UTMB, then I discovered the distance. And from there, I started to look out to other races on that distance, and so that it was many things all around the world. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right. So that was 1974. The next one is on my list is a bit further down. It's 1978. 1978. That's a historic moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was first Hemisphere Traverse.
Yeah. Because when I saw you put that on the list, I was like, what's going on here? Why did he put that on the list? And I wonder what made you put that on the list, first of all?
Well, it's a traverse. It's a traverse that it's a long. It's somehow technical, and to see that the first time that they did it, it was pretty fast. So it means in 11 hours means that the guy was like going pretty fast. It's cool. So it means it's part of the fast running and alpinism at the time. So it should be here.
Yeah. And when did you discover this? Was this before or after you went to Tromsø?
Much after, actually. I when we were in Tromsø, I think it was Emily that told me about the Hemisphere Traverse, and then I had done it like a few times. But actually, it was later, like I think maybe 2 years ago, that I was just doing a bit more research on those, and it just popped up that this first time. I think I was looking about the times on Hemisphere Traverse, and I saw that the first time that it was done, it was pretty fast. So then it's when I discovered like just a couple of years ago.
All right, because that was actually that's on my bucket list in life is to take that record from
you. Yeah,
you
should do
you.
It. It's a nice. it's very possible. I would say, yeah, yeah.
You think so?
It's a very nice traverse. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm sure.
Because I'm wondering, like, how hard did you push when you took that record? Because you have it's a pretty cool video on YouTube. Obviously, you took some time to change batteries and take photos and film. So, how much did you actually push?
Well, like it was like a fast training run, so probably if you are in like racing mode, like you can go much faster. I was filming a bit and I was enjoying a bit, and I wasn't like I was training that morning and after that, so it wasn't really like focusing on this. But I was going fast, of course. But yeah, it's not that you are in a race mood or like a pushing mood.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, so that's my goal. I'm going to try to do that late summer, autumn.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah. Well, I'll keep you updated if I manage to take it. And
sure.
It'll be fun. And the same year, Reinhold Messner and his friend, what's his first name? How about,
Peter Haveler.
Yeah, yeah. They climbed Everest, alpine style, without oxygen. So it's a big year for alpinism.
Yeah, well, like I think Messner first, Hermann Bull, and then mostly Messner, they took what was like the alpine style, how people was climbing in the Alps, in the Himalayas, and that make like a revolution. Like if today, like alpinism, how it is today, it's we cannot understand without Messner and his climbs, like his climbing in Everest with Haveler, it made possible to say, okay, we can climb all the mountains without oxygen. And he's climbed in a few years after, in the 80s, I think it was, or 82, alone, opening a new route. Like it means that, yeah, it's he was like really pushing the alpine style in the Himalayas. And that set another another level on what was possible. Like I think alpinism today, it's how it is because Messner.
Mm. Did you talk with Messner before you went to Everest?
No, I have never met him actually.
Oh, really? Okay. All right. But yeah, I mean, he's a big inspiration though.
Yeah, sure. Yes. Like what he did, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. And then down in 1979, we have another Norwegian event, the Stoltenkleven Up in Bergen. Have you done it?
I have never done it. No? I should go sometime probably, but it looks like painful. Like have you done it?
Yeah, I did it once. Yeah. It's horrible.
It's pure lactate. No, it's like the pure acid lactic in the legs and it's crazy. Like I think like a few athletes has been doing it. Like I think the Ingebrigtsen has been there some years and it's a very cool event. Like I love to watch the videos and I'm friend with Stian and Torbjorn and have the records and yeah, it's so cool like to see how much they push.
Yeah, it's I just googled it. It's 910 meters long. And it has an elevation gain of 379 meters. So it's pretty steep. It's mostly on staircases.
Yeah, it's all stairs and they are just flying up.
Yeah, and the record is 7 minutes and 46 seconds.
It was ridiculous. It has been like for a long time from Torbjörn, and I think like last year or 2 years ago it was Stian that broke it.
Wow. All right. And then you know another Messner event, soloed Everest in 1980, and then I have this way all the way down to 1983. And that's the first edition of the Leadville. Isn't it called Leadville 100? It says Leadville 101 on the list.
Yeah, it's Leadville 100 actually.
Yeah.
And those years it was like a lot of ultra races like popping up in US, like the Leadville, Hard Rock. I think it was just some years after it was the Bear, I think. It was many 100 miles that started in the US, so like really like meaning that it was many people interested on race these races.
Yeah, that's interesting, and it just proves that this sport is very young.
Sure that ultra running, well, we can see that it was very like it comes back to the pedestrians at the beginning, but as a structured sport, like it's very young.
It's commercial version, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
1986 was the year of three major ultra marathons. It was the Mount Olympus, the Barclay marathons, and Marathon des Sables. I don't know, just coincidence. Three.
Yeah, it's three cool races. Mm. I have not done any of them, but Mount Olympus I has been there, and Barclay is just like such a cool event. It looks like so crazy, So it's we can see that now the movement it was really like an expansion.
That's classic. When you know you tell people that you do ultra running, let's say you're at work and the people you speak to, they've never heard of ultra running, but they've seen the documentary. And
Barclays,
So you say you do ultra marathons, and they're like, they're always like, so are you gonna do Barclay one day?
Yeah.
Are you gonna do Barclay one day?
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Like I think more like an adventure than a race, but I think it's a very cool thing to do sometime.
But first, you need to figure out how to get into the race.
And that's I have some friends that they have been racing, so probably they can give me some context.
My best friend, he knows how to get in, but he won't tell me. So
no, wow, no, that then no. Yeah.
Huh. 1990, that's my next one. I highlighted that because it's it's a new speed record on Everest without oxygen.
Yeah, that was Marbatar. Yeah, he was a very, very talented climber. He was doing a lot of cool stuff in the Alps and in the Pyrenees. And I think Marbatar and Benoît Chamou, both from France, they really did some crazy fast times in the Himalayas those years. I think that generation was just like nuts. Like Marbatar was like running these summits. Chamou was running also very fast in K2 or in Everest too. It was also like Jean-Marc Boban at the time that he was like flying, base jumping and like climbing and skiing. I'm like Christophe Profit also doing crazy stuff. So I think that generation in the late 80s to the middle 90s, it was just like a couple of people from France and from Slovenia, mostly, that they were just doing like very, very crazy stuff. Like after the Polish, after Messner and the Polish in Himalaya, I think this generation of French and Slovenian climbers, it was just amazing. Like they did things that they has not been repeated, and they has not been, not only repeated, but nobody's taking the risks and the chances that these guys were doing. Mm.
All right. And in 90, actually the same year, I said a lot of events the same year, I highlighted this thing, which is the first vertical kilometer, which was in Italy. Was it the first vertical kilometer in the world and it was in Italy, or was it the first one in Italy?
No, I think it's probably in the world. Like I think it all started with like the sky running movement. Mm. So actually that was Marino Giacometti, that he's an Italian alpinist. He was doing also like crazy fast stuff in the Himalayas. He had the Pumori FKT and Monte Rosa, Mont Blanc FKT. So he was a very talented technical and fast climber, and he started his movement, the sky running. So taking like athletes like Bruno Brunot, like Ricardo Mejia, Ettore, Fabio Meraldi, and he was taking these people to different places to try to go to the races and to go fast in different mountains. And it was the beginning of the vertical kilometers, because it seemed like logical to do 1,000 meters. And then it was a few years after, like the first races up to Mont Blanc, to Mont Rose, to the first sky running trophy around the world. So it was actually those years that the sky running movement started, and all these guys like Brunot and Meraldi and Carpenter and Mejia, they did all these crazy records.
You were born in 1987, right?
Yeah, 87. Yeah,
so you grew up, with these names and how much of this were you exposed to?
Well, like not as a child, but probably when I started like at 13, 14 years old, I started to kind of follow them, because then it was when I started to be more introduced to ski mountaineering and to sky running. So then I started to follow them.
Yeah, because I was curious, because I grew up with soccer or football, and that was kind of that's what we're expected of us, just to be good football players. But and I was just wondering, like, if you grew up in the Alps or in the Pyrenees, is skyrunning the sport to succeed at? I don't know.
Well, like it's not like for sure, like it's football, the main sport everywhere in the world. But
yeah,
I would say like nowadays, like mountain running in Spain or in France, it's a pretty big sport.
Yeah. Okay. Now 1992, first edition of the Hard Rock 100. You've done that race.
I have done four times. Yeah. One, like my favorite race on ultra running, like just
is
the
it?
Ambience, the atmosphere. Yeah, by far. Like because it's a nice place, nice landscape, but the ambience and the atmosphere, it's just like amazing. It's so familiar, it's so cool. Like I just love it. It's not about the race, it's all what's around that it makes so special.
Yeah. All right. 93 first edition of the FILA Skyrunner trophy. Is that that's the name of the skyrunning or early versions of the skyrunning World Series?
Yeah, that was the first years they were sponsored by FILA, and it was this group of guys that it was like Carpenter that we see that in 93 he did the Pike's Peak marathon record. It was Bruno Brunot that I think it was in 95 that he did also the Matterhorn, and Jean Pellisset, and all like kind of command by Marino Giacometti. So it was, yeah, really in these years that also it was all these crazy events and the races. It was not only these records, but also like races like Trofeo Kima, like Dolomites Sky Race, like Zegama, they started to be born.
So early 90s, mid 90s, that's when it all started, kind of.
Yeah, like the sky running movement and all these more like technical races.
Yeah. 93, same thing. Matt Carpenter did the legendary record on Pike's Peak.
It's an amazing, like it's crazy fast, like the uphill time and the up and down time that he did there is
you were not like you're struggling performance. You're struggling with beating it.
Yeah, well, like I think it needs to be like really perfect conditions and like really have a specific training to be close to his times, and like what he did, it's just like it's a huge performance.
Yeah. And then there's the Matterhorn record in 1995. I don't know. I just highlighted it because you beat it, and it's I don't know how high do you put that on your list of achievements, your record on Matterhorn?
Well, like in terms of record, I would say it's my best performance, because like most of the times, like I always like put it like the FKTs in between my season, so it was never like very planning for it. So it was mostly okay, I have like 1 week in between this race and the race, so can we go to Aconcagua to do that, or can we go to Denali, or can we go to whatever it is. So it was never like a lot of preparation, specific preparation for something. But Matterhorn, I say okay, all these months I only plan for it, so I was really preparing it, and and then I really waited to the day I was feeling good to do it, not only like I needed to do today because I have other things to do after, but I would say it was the time that I took the preparation that I needed, and I really waited for the best conditions to do it. And I think that day everything went perfect. Mm-hmm. I was feeling good, conditions were great, and I had like one of my best days out in running mountains.
Awesome. And the same year, Trofeo Kima was the first edition.
We said, like it was the sky running movement. That it started to do races all over.
I'm supposed to do Kima this year, but we'll see if it's gonna happen.
Yeah, let's see if it happens. It's an amazing race. It's one of the it's so cool, like technical and pretty high technical, I would say. Yeah,
compared to Tromsø Sky Race, how technical is Kima?
It's, I would say, in average is the same. It's more alpine terrain than in Tromsø, but it's not, it don't have this kind of forest part that it's more like also technical in Tromsø, but it's more like alpine terrain on Kima.
Okay yeah, we'll see. I'll hope for the best that I don't know. Do you think it's gonna happen? It's in late
August. No idea.
Yeah, it's hard to predict.
Yeah, it's so hard to predict right now what's going to be.
Yeah. And then 1998, we have the Dolomites Sky Race. So more and more Sky Races are popping up.
Yeah, 98, it was Dolomites, and then 2002, like the Gamma. Then it was really like sky running movement at its highest point.
Yeah, and then at the same time, you know, we see, as you talked about, you know, these big 100-mile races were starting to become more popular. and it was 2003 first edition of the UTMB. It's
yeah, I mean, I think that race it really made like ultra trail like popular at least in Europe. I think because the location, like to be in Chamonix, to have the Mont Blanc, and then it's just like a very logical circuit to run around, and yeah, it made I think today ultra running it's so popular also because UTMB really made but because it's there and people really wants to race it and it it really attracts everybody to get introduced to ultra running.
How old were you when you went and won UTMB?
I think I was, I don't remember if I was like on the 19 years old or 20 years old, but something like that, yeah, 19 or 20.
All right, that's pretty young. Yeah, 2005, you did something because I highlighted this and I think I highlighted it because it was the first time on this list that I saw your name, which means you have typed your name into the list. First of all, what was it you did and how does it feel to put your name on that on this list?
Well, like to put the name in the list, like I think I was trying to put like as much as fast climbs in the world. So like on a way, like it never feels good to put your name on list that you do. But on another way, like I would say, okay, yeah, it was something that I did, and it was probably relevant for some things. So it needs to be there as part of this chronology to understand why things happen or on this way. So actually in 2005, it was, I just did like the ascent of Dom Denis des Écrins, that it's a 4,000 meter summit in the French Alps. Mm. That before that, it was Jean Pélissier. So from the early like sky running movement that have it. So for me, it was this introduction to this FKT and to this like sky running movement probably, yeah.
All right. Yeah, I'm guessing if someone else had created this list, your name would be more on the list. So, 2005, you know, Scott Jurek, seventh consecutive win in Western States.
He's a badass. Like he's an amazing guy. Like I really like Scott. He's a very nice person. And he crushed it. Like all his victories in Western States. He has won Hard Rock. He has won Badwater. So ultra running, like he was just like crushing it on those years. Mm.
And then we go to 2008. That's when you won UTMB. Yeah.
And we can see like before, I would say like ultra running was more like considered as an old people thing. So the previous winner of UTMB was Mark Olmo, that he was 58 years old, I think. Mm. And the average would say like it was like 40 years old people. And that year, like I won UTMB, I was 20 years old, I saw now. And then Kyle Skaggs, he was 23 and won Hard Rock with a new record. So like I think that really popped young guys to run long distance. I think my victory in UTMB and Kyle's in Hard Rock can really inspire not only like old people to run long distance, but also like youngers. And that I think that made made like a fresh vision of the ultra world, that it was more like old people fashion before.
All right, maybe that's a very big very significant event in 2008 when kind of the young guns entered and could prove themselves. Actually,
yeah, I think Kyle, yeah. Me, Anton Kuprika, that we said before, mm. that we were kind of young guys and started to pop up in the ultra scene.
Mm. All right. 2009, you continued. I mean, you did a lot of things these years, but you did the GR20. These are and the Tahoe Rim. You said FKTs.
Yeah, it was
that.
kind of combining like a lot of like trail running races, ultras, short distance, and some like FKTs and these kind of long loops.
Mm. And then we see in 2010, I highlighted this because it's Norwegian and pretty cool. Sindre Sæther, do you know him?
I have met him and his father a few times. Åndalsnes is not a big city, so you kind of meet everybody. And that's I think Sindre is he's the second best sport climber in Norway after Magnus and probably the best big wall climber in Norway and one of the best in the world. And his climbs in Trollveggen, Archwall, and the Norwegian road and the Russian road that he has free climb, they are amazing. It's top class climbs, and he was doing free, and he was doing many on non-stop, so very fast climbs.
So yeah he climbed the troll wall, which is the let's see if I remember,
it's the highest vertical wall in Europe, actually.
Really? Yeah, 1200 meters.
Yeah. 1200 meters of vertical.
That's ridiculous.
It is.
It's ridiculous. going down, it's the 2013, that's when you took the record from Bruno Bonaud on Matterhorn.
Was one of my best days. That same year, I started the project, the Summits of My Life project, the year before, and then it was these years, 2013, the Matterhorn, Mont Blanc. I was going to the Elbrus, and then the years after, year after, it was Aconcagua and Denali. So it was kind of my transition also from pure competition to start to be more climbing and doing more alpine stuff.
Yeah. And in 2014, Karl Egloff did the Kilimanjaro in 6 hours 42. What do you think of Egloff and his him stealing records from you? Do you feel like you have to go back and take it back?
No, not at all. I think you don't steal a record. A record is to be break, and it's always cool to see someone doing something so you can improve, and you can talk to this person, say, okay, I can maybe improve on that, or I can do that better. And to see that someone is breaking it, it means that he's doing things better. So it gets inspiration. And I think it's not about going back to the place to do it better. I think it's better to put the energy into do other things. And actually, I know Carla from some years now. He's a very nice guy. He's a very humble person, and a very he's a very nice person and an amazing athlete on altitude. He's so good on pacing himself in altitude, I'm so happy that he's doing this and that he's going to do some records and some races and things, and especially he's inspiring a lot the South American community, and that's I think what Carl is doing is great, and knowing Carl as a person, he's an amazing human being.
In 2016, you did it's on the list. You did the you linked up 7 summits in Romsdalen in 23 hours. That project has not been. I mean, I know there's a video from it, but can you?
Yeah, like I.
Yeah.
Well, I did a GoPro video, GoPro that, and then. But actually, that was two friends from here, Ola Hobdenak and Niels Nielsen. They had done that on skis, linking all the 7 summits with doing the link ups with Carl from base to base. And actually, I was really inspired by them. Ola is one of the best skiers I have ever seen, and one of the best Eskimo racers from Norway, and Niels, both they are good friends. So I was very inspired by them, and I wanted to do it, trying to do it, linking it without like taking the car. And I just by home, like I finished on my house. So that was a very cool day out.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool. 2016, there are a lot of FKTs. I don't know why, but just like a bunch of FKTs. Jim Walmsley did the rim to rim and the, let's see here, rim. How many rims are there?
But rim to rim.
A lot of FKTs
years. Yeah, I think it's a lot of like competitors like Jim Walmsley or like François Den or like Jasmine. Or as we said before, like also at that time, I think Mike Guardian or Scott Jurek, a bit before, I think it was the year before. But they were like doing all these SKTs, so not only racing, but taking these classical trails like the GR20, the Rim to Rim, the Nolans, or like the Appalachian Trail. So it's great to see competitors going out to not only being running with a beep, but to go out to do these more like adventure things.
Yeah, and that's just 4 years ago. And you know, this now we're stuck with the coronavirus, and people are I think, you know, it's already become the year of FKTs. And
I think it will be a good year for that, because in events we cannot go because it's too many people. And it will take a lot of time until we can race big races. But you can go like on your trails around your home and do FKTs, because that's only you by yourself, and it's like social distancing when you do the activity. So I think it will be a good year for that.
Yeah, we actually started a race here in Oslo in our local trails. You have to do it on your own though. So you combine three trails. It's called the Blaze Cup.
Nice.
You can go to blazecup.no. It's super cool, and a lot of people have signed up, and they're doing an awesome job. Like they're crushing the records every single day. So
That's cool.
Yeah. In 2017, you did an FKT, a small FKT on the tallest mountain in the world. I don't know. Should we talk about that?
It was a great experience. Like I was there in 2015 when the earthquake, and we could not go to the mountain. In 2016, we went during the monsoon. We had a lot of like avalanche, so it was not very cool. And then like in 2017, I went back there on the spring, so it was like icy, so you don't need to worry much about avalanche. So it's more only like physical. And it was, it had evolved a lot, like my vision to go to the mountains. Before, it was more like just a competition, like to beat the time. By then, it was more about trying to do in a style. So I wanted to see if it was possible for me to climb the mountain by fair means. I mean, like without any assistance and carrying all the gear I needed by myself. And that was it. Like, actually, I did this first climb. And I didn't feel that good. I had some gastro problems, but it was cool. Like it's nice. But actually, when I went back to the feet of the mountain, we had like some extra time until going back home, until the plane. So it was like, okay, what we do like next week? And like, well, it's logical. Like you are there, it's a mountain. And then I started to think, it might be cool like to see how the body reacts, like how the training or how the body will feel like on being up again, like the tiredness or whatever. It was cool to go up again to see how the body reacted. And it's not secret. It's hard the second time, like you feel the tiredness, but it was very cool, like the experience, and to see that, it was for me possible to be up there without without oxygen.
Mm. You went back last year, did you? What did you do in Kumbu last year?
Yeah, I was back in the south side of Everest, so in the other side of the mountain. I wanted to do some different stuff, but Yeah, it was a very, very bad autumn. We had a lot of precipitation in September, not a single day of sun. And then when the sun came in October, we had a very short window and it was like a lot of avalanche. So I could manage to be up to 8,300 meters. But yeah, it was a bit too risky. But it was like, I would say like I the experience in last year being alone in the mountain, it was at that point, it was not any other expedition in the mountain, and being able to climb much lighter than in 2017 and on, let's say, in a better style, because it was not other expeditions in the mountain. Even if I didn't reach the summit, like just to be up there and moving in this altitude, it was much, I would say, like almost a better experience.
Hmm. Are you going to go back, you think?
Well, I want to go back to Himalayas. I don't know if which mountain, but yeah, I have a lot of ideas and projects in those mountains. I love Nepal. I love the country, the people, and of course the mountains. It's endless of possibilities.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. Now in scrolling down, we're almost at the end of the list. Your wife is on the list.
Yeah, she's done like a bunch of like very cool stuff, and yeah, last year she did a lot of like incredible things. And actually, this week, like in June, she was going down to Mont Blanc. She did the Mont Blanc FKT, so going from Chamonix to the summit and back. And 2 days after, so one rest day in between, she was going to the Mont Rose and doing the FKT there and like really crushing it. She was flying that day. So in like 3 days, she did like two huge FKTs.
Wow. Well deserved to be on that list, definitely. And yeah, and there's your FKT on the Bob Graham round in 2018. And the next, actually, that's the last highlight on my list. I don't know. Is there anything else you would like to talk about here?
Well, I think it's cool that the Bob Graham, like it's closing the list, because it's kind of going back to the beginning.
Mm.
Because like fell running, it was where this sport begins, like in the UK, and it's also in the UK that kind of alpinism and exploration begins. So like it was for me, it was a very cool experience to go there to run this round, because you could really feel like the age of the sport there, like how people has been running in those fells for centuries. And it's like, okay, we think that we are doing cool things and we are like doing new things, but when you go and run there, you realize that we are just doing things that they has been done for centuries, and that you can be part of the history. And it's great to go there to see where this history begin.
Mm. You think we're going to see more of that now because of the race situation? I mean, of course, do you think like after we go back to normal, do you think people are going to do less races and just be fine with doing these kind of projects?
Well, I hope that this corona situation also makes us realize like what's the model that we want to be. Like we are facing now this crisis, but I think the big crisis that is now here, and it will be really coming, it's the climate crisis that will really affect us and the next generations. And I think that we need to rethink the model. Like when I started racing, it was normal to just take a plane, like to do a race in Japan, and then the week after to go to Malaysia, and then the week after to be to US, and then and that's a model that today we see that is not it shouldn't be possible, because it's the toll that it's taking the environment on, that is too big. And I hope that with these times now, that we are able, everybody, runners, organizations, serious federations, sponsors, to think what's the future of the sport, and what's the future of the structure of the sport, thinking about, we love mountains, we love outdoors. We can call that we are, I think everybody that is running outdoors is an outdoor enthusiast. It's someone that loves the nature. And on the other way, we are maybe one of the biggest threats to that, because we are like just moving so much. So maybe it's the time to reflect and say, okay, we can still travel, we can still do races and do projects, but maybe we need to rethink about the rhythm and the and how we do it. Yeah.
Mm. All right. Our time is up, Khalil.
Thank you very much. It was a nice talk.
Yeah, it was. Thanks so much for taking your time and going through this huge list. And I don't know where it's gonna end up. Like the next years, where is alpinism and running? Where it's gonna head? I have no idea.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. Like to see how it's going and how the influences affects and what new people is bringing up.
Mm. Any last tips for my listeners?
Well, enjoy this period, to take the best of it, to enjoy the outdoors, enjoy the places that we have around home. Many times we think about adventures to be far away, but we can just take the backyard and explore it. And I'm sure it's great adventures on there.
Mm. All right. Let's end there. I'll just stop the recording here and we can finish up.
Yeah, all right. Perfect.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that chat with Kilian as much as I did. As I mentioned in the intro, check out patreon.com/nedaproject to support the production of this show, and I'll speak to you in the next episode. Okay? Over out, Roger and Knut.
You know, Norway has an incredible story about mountaineering, and it's many of the greatest alpinists are from here. If you see the big climbs in Pakistan, the Trango Towers and things like that, they were made from Norwegians. So I think of course it's very hardcore Norwegians climbing around and running. I don't remember which race was exactly, but I was reading that they were some nude races. Also, people was running nude, and that's a funny thing, that it was really connected to nature. I read somewhere that it was a note saying that in the 1820 some, it was this fair race, this nude fair race in this village, that couldn't be stopped by the police, even if they try hard. So that the police couldn't stop the nude fair races at the time. Nude. It's very hardcore Norwegians climbing around.
Said, there are those of us who observe and those of us who are here to entertain.
We're here to entertain you, bitch.